Hi, everyone. It's Sandy Cruz from Sandy K Nutrition, health and lifestyle queen. And I'm here to show you that balanced living works. This is especially for all you ladies over 40. We will cover a range of exciting topics with many special guests, and I really look forward to this season. Bye for now. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Sandy K Nutrition, health and lifestyle queen. Today with me, I have a special guest. His name is Sam Visnick, and he is a certified massage therapy and the founder of the Release Muscle Therapy Technique. And we had a great talk. I'm not going to spoil it now, but we talked all about chronic pain. We talked about chronic pain that happens in midlife. It was really a good conversation. We also talked about why his technique is different from a lot of the other techniques you see out there for chronic pain. And you see a lot of this starting to happen in midlife. People are getting diagnosed with arthritis. People are having issues with certain joints, old injuries. I mean, I think it's pretty rampant. And then what else is happening is people are injuring themselves and not recuperating from that injury. And the one thing I always say, of course, as a holistic health practitioner, is that it's really important, A, to fuel your body with good food, B, to move your body regularly. If you ain't moving it, you're gonna lose it. Actually, it's kind of funny because my dad says that. He says that he's 84 and he's like, well, you know, if I don't move it, I'm gonna lose it. And I'm in more pain when I don't move than when I do move. And I truly believe that this is fact. And the other thing that causes pain, inflammation in the body. And so I'm always like of the thought that we need a team. We need a team of wellness practitioners. We need our general physicians. They are our best advocate and they do a lot of things for us. They are the person who really should be our go-to. Then we have our specialists. So I have an endocrinologist because I have no thyroid and had thyroid cancer. So we all need our team. I also have a naturopath doctor. I love her to death. She is amazing. We have lots of great conversations. She is a wealth of knowledge, and she's also able to prescribe to me customized bioidentical hormones, which I am of the belief that every woman in midlife really is probably going to want them or need them at some point. And then there are other practitioners. I have two different osteopaths that I go to. And let's see, who else? Of course, then there's good old me. I am a registered holistic nutritionist, and I look at the root cause of symptoms. That's my big thing. So really, if you think that in this day and age, you can get away with just going to see your GP and that's it, I'm sorry, but you are not going to have a well-rounded wellness program. Everyone has their expertise. Your general physician is not an expert in nutraceuticals. Just saying. Your general physician is also not an expert on nutrition unless they're specially trained. But these are the facts, guys. These are the facts. And this is how it is in Canada. And unfortunately, in Canada, we've become so accustomed to only doing what OHIP pays for. This is our paid medical, whatever system you want to call it. But that's the thing, is that nobody wants to put in extra for their best health. And in order to have your best health and to age better, you're going to have to do more. These are the facts. You're just going to have to do more. whether it's working with a naturopath doctor, whether it's working with your osteopath, whether it's working with your holistic nutritionist or other holistic health practitioner. Some work with a functional medicine doctor. Whatever it is that resonates with you, I urge you to go and find it. The problem is, at least here, is that we've grown so accustomed to having everything paid for that we feel we shouldn't have to pay for anything else on top of it. So we will go and continue to spend that $5 a day on a Starbucks, and yet we won't go and spend that monthly tab on seeing a holistic health practitioner, which will look at things very differently. Now, myself, as a holistic health practitioner, I do not diagnose, cure, or heal diseases, but guess what I do? I look at symptoms that people are experiencing before they get sick. Although I have had some individual clients who have had some chronic illnesses, that's fine. But really what I look at is, what are you feeling and how can we rebalance the body with food as medicine, with good quality third-party tested nutraceuticals that actually do something in the body? And then there's homeopathics. And then there's, of course, peptide bioregulators. Those are considered food supplements. These are not the synthetic peptides that a lot of people are talking about. But I work a lot with these things. So what I'm going to say to you, I love practitioners such as Sam. They're doing more. And they're doing more to help people. They're giving people the tools to be able to do more at home. Anyway, I am just so passionate about really having your team. Your team that looks out for your best health. And of course, without self-awareness, none of this matters. So you got to have some self-awareness when things are going wrong, when you're feeling something different, especially in midlife. And Sam and I actually talk about this, about how chronic pain, you know, varies at different points in people's lives. And during midlife, it really escalates. So I'm really excited to present this interview to you. And please, 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 I still have my contest going on, guys. I haven't done the draw yet for the DNAge Biological Age Test Kit. Open to entries in North America only. And all you have to do is review my podcast. Come on, if you listen every week, give me some nice words and a 5-star review. Then I'm going to enter you into a draw and you can win this. This is a $300 value, US. So that's way more than Canadian, guys. So do that for me and then send me an email and let me know that you've done this. Sandy@sandyknutrition.ca. And that way I'm going to enter you to win. And who doesn't want to know what their biological age is? I'm still waiting for my husband's results. This is going to be really good, guys, because I will be announcing it when I find out. Because we all know, I've already told everybody who listens, that mine is my age, pretty much, give or take a few months. And I was a little disappointed with that, but I also know why, and I understand why. And I'm actually going to try and move that needle down a little bit more. And that's to come. It'll be not until the new year. So with that, make sure you go and follow me on Instagram @SandyKNutrition, Facebook, SandyKNutrition. I'm on TikTok. Oh my God, you guys, I'm on TikTok and I went viral this week. And I didn't go viral for one of my nutrition videos. I went viral for, it's my niece dog and my nephew cat. And I posted that video and I think I'm close to 400,000 views on TikTok for that video. Anyway, I am on TikTok and I'm also on Twitter, but yes, definitely go and follow me there. And now I will cut on through to my interview with Sam Visnick. Hi everyone. Welcome to Sandy K Nutrition, Health and Lifestyle Queen. Today with me, I have a special guest. His name is Sam Visnick, or Vishnich, if you're Eastern European like I am. He is a certified massage therapist and a release muscle therapy founder. So he's the actual founder of this technique. And for me, it's really important to understand mobility, just like it is for a lot of people during midlife. And this is why I was really excited to meet you, Sam. And so welcome to my show, Sam.
Thank you so much for having me, and looking forward to this talk.
Yeah, me too. And, you know, you're doing something a little bit different. And so you 100% caught my eye. And I thought, wow, you know, this could be a really good conversation, because I do know a lot of individuals who experience chronic pain starting in midlife. I mean, you can have it obviously even younger, but in midlife, it seems to really turn on. So I always love to ask all of my guests, how did you get into this industry? How'd you get into this field?
Well, I've been doing this now for about 20 years now. I'm starting to lose track of that. But I first started as a fitness trainer when I was about 19 years old. Got out of high school, and it was kind of like after a few kind of manual labor jobs, I realized, hey, I like to just be physically active. I love to go to the gym. And it just kind of came into an opportunity to actually go and get a job as a trainer and teach people fitness. And I was kind of a young meathead, loved to lift heavy weights and so forth. So to me, that was great and just get to hang out at the gym. But this was at the time where the field was really starting to move into what we call more of a functional movement or a functional fitness kind of paradigm. This is about 99, 2000. And trainers were being taught things like looking at posture, looking at the way that people moved, and see if you can help them with this. And I think this is really when the industry was, again, very young, and a lot of the fitness realm was about bodybuilding techniques. So nobody really looked at those sorts of things. So there's this movement of these things that were more like around physical therapy-ish type stuff that went into training. And so when I was working at the gym, I think you quickly realized that most of the people that came in that you were working with were, you know, oftentimes hadn't worked out in a long time or hadn't been physically active. And they would come in and they were generally deconditioned, had lots of aches and pains. And they were concerned about having to start lifting weights or whatever, because it wasn't really well known that you could, you know, hey, if I don't want to injure my back by lifting, I don't want to do, you know, all these sorts of things. And when I took these trainings, who were teaching us how to do these assessments and evaluations with people and get people into a fitness program that was safe and effective for them, I felt very comfortable in working with these types of issues. And my colleagues did not. So a lot of people were just like, I don't like working with someone with back pain or knee pain. I don't want to hurt them. And they would just dish them off to me. And very early on, I just kind of became that person in the gym and in the fitness realm where somebody had an issue that other people felt uncomfortable working with. They just sent them to me and I was happy to take them. So, you know, fast forward a number of years, I had looked up all the references and the textbooks and so forth and figured out where all this information came from. And it just became an obsession. All I did was look at structural mechanics, corrective exercise, figuring out how to do all of these different things. And I was getting success with people, you know, and almost I would say a little bit by accident, but because a lot of times I was working toward just kind of getting people fit and working out and working around their injuries. And what we ended up finding is that we were actually getting rid of a lot of these aches and pains that people had. So, you know, I went full speed at it. And one of my mentors at the time had said, you really need to get some kind of license to do hands-on therapy to complement your work. It'll make it a lot better. So I went to massage school. I took neuromuscular therapy courses, which is a sub-technique within the massage field, and just lots and lots of trainings. And to make a long story short, I delved into a lot of other areas because what we know about pain is that there's many different factors within the context of someone's lifestyle, nutrition, inflammation, you know, mindset, all of these different things that affect pain. And took a lot of courses and training on that. And over time, the challenge was trying to integrate all of that into a practice without it being so messy. And it took me a long time to do that. It's always still a work in progress, just try to put all this stuff together. And but that has been the what is the result is release muscle therapy, which is what I do now.
Hmm. Okay. So you said a few things in here, and I find it really fascinating because I myself started working out with a personal trainer 3.5 years ago. It has changed my life. But it's interesting because you just kind of touched on this. Instead of avoiding the area, so every once in a blue moon, I'll have like, you know, my hip's just going to bug me. And it could last for a while. It doesn't go away in a day. You know, I'm not 20 years old. But we still do exercise. And the funny thing is, when I go that stretch where I'm not doing anything, it bothers me more. So, but I work with a personal trainer who understands and knows my injury. So, you know, talk to me about that, because I think, so you're a massage therapist, you're a trainer, you kind of have a lot of techniques in one. Like, so I just want to reiterate how important it is to still move, even if you have an injury, right? Like, would you agree with that?
Yeah. And so the first thing we should probably do before we kind of dive into that is make sure that we understand the difference between acute pain and chronic pain.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are not aware of this, but these are two completely different animals. I am not an expert at acute pain. You know, healthcare providers like medical doctors, EMT, you know, these people are experts at this acute pain model because it usually is a result of damage that's going on to the tissue or an injury. So these things tend to have their own period of time for healing. So if you, you know, you strain a muscle, it's going to take a couple of weeks for it to recover. If you yank on a tendon and irritate it, it'll take a little bit longer and so forth. You break a bone, you're in a cast for a period of time.
Right.
So these things usually have their own period of time of healing. Now, generally, it's most experts will agree that in 6 months, everything in the body heals. All the tissue, even if you get mangled in a car accident, for the most part, tissue heals in 6 months. If you are experiencing ongoing pain after the expected time of tissue healing, that's what we call chronic pain.
Okay.
So this is different. And what we say is that chronic pain is no longer a tissue issue. Chronic pain is a nerve issue. It's a nerve sensitivity problem. So when we think about it in that way, there's a lot of things that change in our approach to dealing with it. And it's not uncommon today to see people that, again, they don't really understand the difference between these two. And it often generates a whole situation where people are oftentimes afraid to move, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody says, for example, I had a disc bulge 3 years ago or 4 years ago, and it's caused me problems ever since. And I don't want to do this exercise because of my bulging disc.
Okay.
And so there's a fundamental kind of misunderstanding in that, you know, is in, and there's a lot of blame to go around on this, but a lot of times it's end up because of the way that our healthcare system works, where there's not a lot of education on these topics, that disc issues will oftentimes bulge and reabsorb and so forth within 3 to 6 months. There's a lot of research on that. So you technically can't be dealing with a disc bulge issue for years after the initial issue. So if there's pain that's going on after that, we're dealing with an ongoing nerve sensitivity-based problem. And therefore, we oftentimes develop behaviors and the way that we avoid things, like, for example, doing a certain exercise and so forth in fear that we're creating more damage. So we oftentimes avoid those things. And that avoidance is what sustains the pattern. It keeps it going. So when a trainer, physical therapist, and so forth comes along and says, hey, you know what? I'm going to modify this exercise for you. We're going to make sure that we don't put pressure on a disc or a joint or whatever.
Right.
And you feel safe enough to do the exercise. Guess what starts happening? You're like, oh, well, I guess I can move without bothering this. And that actually makes it start to feel better. But it's not only just the exercise, but that entire context of things and messages that we're sending our nervous system about being safe and starting to attempt things that we thought were unsafe, that starts to break up that pain cycle. So it's a very fascinating kind of sequence of events that goes into that. And I think clearly demonstrates the complexity of dealing with something like chronic pain.
Okay, that's really interesting, because so I've heard this before, and tell me your thoughts on this if you have any, but I broke my foot, my heel, and I never did anything to recuperate. I refused to get a cast. I was really bad. And I would take my cast off and drive anyway. And this was about 10 years ago. And then I was doing Pilates. Then I developed chronic Achilles tendonitis in the same area. Then, and every once in a blue moon, when my hip acts up, it's the same side. As like, is it possible that if you have an old injury and you really don't take care of it, that it can kind of move and manifest in different ways and affect the body? What do you think of that?
Yes. I mean, well, we have to consider the issue of, for example, that the way that we alter, the way that we move and the way that we behave as a result of having issues like pain. In the beginning, acute pain, when something happens, we're very aware of it. You know, so if roll your ankle and the thing swells up like a softball, we don't walk on it. We generally move in a way where we avoid it because we're getting these instant pain messages that are constantly, you know, noxious enough to get our attention. But what happens is that as tissue heals and things become chronic, they're certainly not so severe anymore, right? Because they have cooled off, but they oftentimes still kind of bother us in some way. But you won't constantly be focused on that for long periods of time. You know, sometimes people do, but they tend to kind of fall into the subconscious. We kind of start to learn how to block them out. So a lot of times, if we move in certain ways and so forth, and then it creates an issue where we might feel a little bit of achiness or whatever, a lot of times our brain just starts to delete it. We don't even pay attention to it. And we have no longer the awareness that we are not moving in the way that we used to or using our body in the way that we used to. And that can cause certain things, like we tend to favor one side of the body more than the other, and we just didn't return back to those old behavioral ways of moving prior to the injury. Mm-hmm. And that may set us up for a greater likelihood of developing issues with that later, because maybe for years you're walking in a way where your brain still thinks that you still have an injury and you don't. Mm-hmm. And you might not be aware of this because you're like, well, my foot doesn't hurt. I'm probably not doing that, but you might do it. Because you're just not conscious or aware of it anymore. And that's kind of part of, I think, what a lot of people miss with things like physical therapy. Even though I do what I do, I am somehow, people might get the impression that I'm against, you know, the way that the medical system handles injuries or how physical therapy works. And that's not the case at all. I just think that we need to extend the work past that. And we need to make sure that we're getting a good flow of things. Like, for example, in physical therapy, after an injury, again, you have this period of time where the tissue is going to heal pretty much regardless of what you do.
Right.
So when you injure your foot, let's say it doesn't need surgery, it doesn't need anything in particular, it just needs some time. That's great. And when you go to physical therapy, the physical therapy might not be about fixing the injured tissue because the tissue is going to heal on its own. But what the physical therapy in that case will do is to teach you how to move that limb and feel confident and safe about it so that as you kind of get back to your daily routine, you haven't developed behaviors of avoidance of that injured side. And if you don't do these things sometimes everything goes back to normal, right? But sometimes it doesn't. And we know, for example, in the literature that about 20-25% of people who have a pain issue develop chronic pain. So that's one quarter. 25% of people will develop chronic pain. And there's a lot of different reasons for this. But I think that might be something that plays into that as well.
Would you say that, let's say, the older you are in terms of having that, let's say, an acute injury, you fall, you hurt your knee, and then you have to do physical therapy, would you say that the older you are when that happens, the more likelihood you have to experience chronic pain if you don't address it properly?
That is a super interesting question, and I have a number of different things that I would probably say about that. I say that as we get older, you're not somehow unable to recover so well and so forth. I mean, I don't think that's really the case. I think it has a lot more to do with the general resiliency. I think we all know that when we're younger, we tend to think we're a little bit more superpowered.
Totally.
And that nothing tends to bother us and so forth. And a lot of times things just kind of heal on their own and we don't have to do anything about them. But I think certainly our mindsets change a lot as we get older, and we start to pay attention to more things. We start to have more concerns about things. Like, for example, I'm a massage therapist. So a lot of my career is doing hands-on therapy with people. And if I get an injury to my hand, this is far more concerning to me than when I was 20 years old.
Of course.
So our brain tends to go out to a higher degree of vigilance on certain things because of we know what things more mean in our environment. And I'm talking about this because we talk about this, we could talk about what's called the biopsychosocial model, but essentially when it comes to health, there's a lot more to do around the concepts of health and our perceptions of things and how they affect our lives than just purely the mechanical injury that we have or the pain that we have. It stops us from doing things. if you're an active aging athlete, we would say, so, you know, as you're getting older and you're wanting to participate in more weekend warrior activities and so forth, and those things are very important to you. You like to play basketball on the weekends or go cycling or running. And those are ways that you alleviate stress and you feel better about yourself. And then somehow you sustain some kind of injury or a chronic ache or pain that stops you from doing that. The meaning that we attach to that is heavier, is much heavily more weighted than it is when we're younger. So I think these things tend to kind of manifest differently and sometimes can make it a little bit harder as we move past. I would say that cutoff point seemed to me, for me anyway, it was once I turned about 30. And, you know, as you start to experience these things, it just becomes a different event. And also, it has a lot to do with the messages that we're getting from our healthcare providers, because we are constantly inundated with these messages that, ooh, you're getting older, you got to slow down. Ooh, you're getting older, you got to be careful. You got a bad back. You got a arthritis situation. All these messages that in the literature, we could talk about that in the research, does not show at all that it makes you more susceptible to any of these problems. But yet we're constantly being pummeled with these messages, or these what we call memes, that are constantly infecting our mentality. So I think that's all part of that.
Yeah, I would agree. And this is why there's definitely a lot of stigma attached to aging. And, you know, I'm trying to change that narrative. That's, you know, what I'm saying. I'm saying we can all age well, but we maybe need to do a little bit more work behind it. Because, you know, our brains are different, just like what you said. I mean, a 25-year-old brain is very different than a 50-year-old brain in terms of, you know, like I used to go, I had no fear back then. And, you know, I don't know whether it's stress or just maturity. And now, you know, I don't ride those roller coasters like I used to, right? So there's definitely something there. So you also mentioned the release muscle therapy, right? That's what it's called?
Yep.
What is this? This is different than regular massage therapy work. And you created this method, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so tell me about it. What is it?
So, you know, it's sometimes a little difficult to transition conversations between these kind of bigger concepts about pain and then, like, you know, understanding all of that and then how that starts to translate into how do you deal with this on a mechanical level. So we always have to, you know, I say contextualize this and say that the idea of approaching pain is a big topic. And within that, we have these kind of categories in which we deal with pain. We deal with pain from a biochemical perspective. We deal with pain from a mental emotional perspective. We deal with pain on the structural side. So we want to make sure that we understand that, you know, in this conversation as the listeners, when we talk about these structural elements of pain, it is always, always done in the context of the whole. So we don't just kind of look at pain as this purely structural mechanical thing. It involves all of those things. So that is oftentimes kind of part of what makes this complicated, is because we're oftentimes sent a lot of messages that pain is structural mechanical. It always is. And that is absolutely not true. But within that, we have a model and how we handle it. You know, for example, the research does show quite strongly that posture has very low correlation to chronic pain. It really does. But yet that doesn't mean that we throw the baby out with the bathwater. We certainly look at posture because there are certain things that tie into that. So I just always want to frame that before I kind of dive into the details of the kind of structural approach. So when I work with people, I'm oftentimes seeing people not as the first practitioner that somebody has seen by far. Usually they have gone to the doctor, gone to physical therapy. They've been to a number of different practitioners like chiros and so forth. So these people have oftentimes had kind of the once-overs. They've had some therapeutic work done, and usually it hasn't lasted, and sometimes it hasn't worked at all. So they end up in my office. So when I go through about this process, there are certain things that I can now come to expect when people walk in the door, because I'm quite familiar, having done this for so long, about the things that other practitioners tend to do and not do. And a lot of times we see that therapeutic programs are generally more generalized. People are given generalized core exercises. They're given generalized activities and instructions to do. A lot of times people are not given home exercises. They just go to therapy. And sometimes it's once a week. So their body hasn't really been exposed to a lot of movement work.
Yeah, it's not enough.
Some practices, people do all passive care. So they just put some money on the table and they work on them and then they leave and then that's the end of it.
Yeah.
So release muscle therapy was meant to kind of work on addressing part of that problem, which is the therapy does not stop at the door. So we do the things that we do in here, and there's a lot of education and teaching people about things, and we're going to do hands-on techniques and we're going to do exercises, but I'm teaching you how to care for yourself when you're not here. Because chronic pain in particular is what we call a behavioral situation. There's lots of behaviors that you have adopted as a result of dealing with pain that don't just change when you're here. There's things that you do when you're outside of here. So when I do techniques, and let's say on the massage end of things, a lot of the techniques that I have found that have been applied to people, and usually I think most people have been exposed to this, where they usually get very minimal amounts of hands-on therapy or massage work. It's either general massage or some therapy techniques directed at a certain joint, and then that's kind of it. So when people oftentimes see me, let's say a shoulder problem, I oftentimes ask when people come in, did the practitioners that you worked with before, have they ever gone A to Z on every single muscle that's around that shoulder joint? Have you had every single thing in there treated at least once? And in 20 years of this, the answer has never been yes. Okay, so first thing I'll oftentimes do after an evaluation with people, which I clearly do a head to toe, I move people around and I look at their pattern, is to clean out, I call it a clean out, of every single muscle in there. And it's really like exploration, is to determine all the tissues in there that are tight, anything that's really sensitive that should not be so sensitive. And also we test things like, for example, if somebody moves their arm and that's as far as they can move it before they feel pain, every section of muscles that we release will continue testing and we'll see what makes the biggest difference for that person. So it's a good way to both apply the therapeutic work to the person, but also to be able to assess what's the difference that makes the difference for that person. Now, we do very, very thorough massage work. And within that, there's a lot of additional things that we will do. So for example, when we do massage work, a lot of times, or any manual therapy, I should say, for the most part, it's oftentimes perceived as being a purely passive thing, meaning that the therapy is just being done to you, right? You just lay there and you just receive it. The problem with that approach is that your nervous system is not really learning that much. And we need to change that. And what release muscle therapy in the name of it is something that is so wonderfully profound that oftentimes gets omitted and skipped. When I was taught neuromuscular therapy, when we put pressure on a sensitive area, let's say a trigger point or a sensitive knot or whatever we want to call it, and then it feels sore, oftentimes the therapist would say, I was taught this, let me know when that releases. And that's an interesting statement to say. And because we're oftentimes creating a personification that there is an it and that it releases and that we don't know what's going on behind that. So just as simple as altering the phrase work and saying, let me know when you've released that, starts to engage the person into the process. So what I teach people is that when we put pressure on an area that is sensitive, it's sensory input, it's information into your nervous system, which is triggering your brain to pay attention to it. Now, the brain has to make a decision, and it makes a decision of this information is threatening. If it's threatening, what are we going to do? We're going to tighten up, right? We're going to guard ourselves because we don't like that and something bad can happen. Or on the opposite end of that, that information is non-threatening. And if it's non-threatening, then our nervous system is going to let go and not be so concerned about it. So that letting go and the nervous system not feeling threatened by that stimulation is the release. And we can help that process along by doing certain things. Number one, what we're representing in our mind as that area is being stimulated. And number two, what we're doing with our physiology. And the two simplest things to do is number one, breathing. Because when we feel threatened, we tend to tension. We hold our breath. It's so subconscious. We don't even pay attention to it. But the moment we bring our awareness to it, we can relax and we can breathe, which sends safety information to our nervous system. And the second thing is thinking about what we're representing. So if I put my finger here and I push, and then that feels sensitive, quite sensitive, what do you see in your mind? And a lot of people make movies and look at pictures in their mind that are threatening and terrifying. They see muscles tearing apart. They see adhesions breaking up. They see joints popping out of place. And we never seem to ask people what it is that they're representing inside when they feel that sensitivity. Because I don't play those movies in my head when I'm getting a massage. But if a client is doing that, I should know about it. Mm-hmm. Because I need to assist them with reframing that experience to help them understand that you're in a safe environment, that nothing bad is going to happen when we're massaging muscles. And you need to alert your nervous system that that is the case as well. So this process, it seems so simple, but it is unbelievably profound because most people have never had that experience when they're doing any therapeutic work. And that is so rare that actually I've kind of branded it as my own technique.
I like it. I like it. It's very different. It's like I always say, as a practitioner myself, you know, it's not just about food. It's about the body, the mind, the soul, spirit, whatever you want to call it. And the body doesn't heal in silos, right? So yes. I love that. Now, you touched on other practitioners. I think it's really important to understand. So you are a certified massage therapist. Then there's osteopaths. Then there's chiropractors. And so often individuals who have chronic pain will kind of circle around to the different types of practitioners. What is the main difference, at least in the United States, between those?
That's a really good question. And it's hard to generalize these days. I think there are certain generalizations I can make. So if there's any practitioners out there on the podcast, don't get mad at me because I'm sure that there's differences.
Yeah,
but sure. You know, in Canada, for example, a massage therapist has a lot more kind of, I would say it's to say standing as a healthcare based kind of practitioner. There's more training, there's more standardization in the training. Here in the United States, it's different. I'm in California. There's not even a license for massage therapy. There's a state certification. So it's quite a bit different and it's very loose. So education is a key component out of that that vacillates tremendously. Even as a massage therapist, I mean, most people don't kind of see the distinction of what I do as more what I would call clinical massage. Even there's not really a designation for that. I don't do Swedish massage. I don't do deep tissue. It's just kind of not the techniques that I do. My work is based upon pain, and the application of techniques is based upon what I see with somebody. So a lot of times I might not do any massage with somebody and I do movement and exercise work. So it depends. And so I would say that that's a big difference, is that when you look at massage therapists here in the United States, it's more about their training and their competency with orthopedic issues and so forth. And you really have to kind of dig a little bit to see how much that person knows specifically about that. But certainly all massage therapists work with people in pain. That's what the profession, the number one thing that people go get a massage for outside of relaxation is pain.
And tightness, tightness, right?
Yeah, and it depends on what that specialty is.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to things like osteopathy or osteopathic and chiropractic, these disciplines basically were from the same place and they branched very long ago. In the United States, osteopathic doctors are now medical doctors. I think somewhere in the 50s, osteopathic used to be a profession that was very similar to chiropractic, but the medical society came in and basically wanted to probably eliminate the competition and give osteopathic doctors a medical license. And, you know, at some point it kind of veered off from its traditional roots, and most DOs in the United States are just medical doctors. Mm. They can take additional training and osteopathic techniques, but they're like electives in college and most of them don't take it. So there's a stigma associated with that in the DO work today. So most, you will find very rarely DOs, Doctor of Osteopathic, these are medical doctors here in the United States that do traditional osteopathy. And in Los Angeles, there are a number of them. And I've worked with a number of them. They're rare. And in Canada, you have osteopaths, tons of them. There's osteopathic schools, and they teach more traditional osteopathy. And I think that that discipline is a fantastic discipline. It maintains a lot of its roots, which is in manual therapy and looking at the body as a whole. They will do manipulation of the spine and of the joints. They will pump organs doing manual techniques. They believe in a lot of different types of techniques that are engineered at working with the nervous system and creating a state of harmony in the system. And whether or not they do any exercise work really depends on the individual, but I would say largely it's a manual therapy field. We do not have that in the United States.
In Canada, because I've seen a couple of different osteopaths, and I find it's just there's different depending on what school they graduated from. I noticed that. So one is a little bit more harder and harsher, and one is a little bit more gentle, like soft tissue massage almost. So they're different here in Canada, and but the one thing is that they don't crack bones really. Like, would you say that that's a big difference between osteopaths and chiropractors? What do you think?
I think that that's the case. And again, this kind of goes into that final leg of understanding what chiropractic does. And chiropractic in the United States is oddly a big profession, and osteopathic or osteopathy didn't take that route here. But chiropractors kind of went the direction of mostly the model early on of spinal manipulation and vertebral subluxation as being the root cause of things. Now, we know now that that majority of that has research has proven is very untrue. However, that doesn't mean that the techniques aren't valuable, and they clearly are. But it has meant in the United States anyway that chiropractors have oftentimes expanded their practices into a lot of different disciplines. So it is hard these days to generalize with chiropractic, because some chiropractors do nutrition and some of them only do exercise and soft tissue work, and they don't even adjust the spine. And there are definitely a lot of traditional chiropractors that use a traditional model of spinal manipulation, and then that's all they do. So all of these things, when you kind of look at them, and they all, by the way, do massage therapy. So, which is always one of my big grievances, is when you look at these professions that love to fight with each other, and we all know what happens in the industry about whose technique and terrain, you know, chiropractors can adjust people, but their physical therapists can't. These are all just techniques, and they don't really mean that much, because they all have usefulness in some capacity under some circumstances. And you guys all use massage, and I'm not screaming about it, because I do massage all day, every day, and I should have that technique, you know? So you have to kind of get past that, because a lot of times those are the big things between these different factions of therapies. And, you know, they're really all kind of using a lot of the same kinds of tools. And the problem is, it's not the tool. The problem is the approach. The approach and what we know about chronic pain helps determine when the appropriate use of a specific tool is for a given context. Mm-hmm. We all know that not every single person with chronic issues in their back needs a spinal adjustment, needs manipulation. They might need massage. They might need reassurance. They might need exercise. They might not need that at all. Same thing with massage work or any other tool. We have to understand that it's just a tool. We have to know and have a systemic approach to dealing with the problem in order to determine the tool.
Okay, so let's say I'm an individual that has arthritis in my shoulder, and it's osteoarthritis. You know, what's the best thing for me? Where do I go? Do I go to here it's an RMT, you guys say CMT, but registered massage therapist here in Canada, it's normal. You guys are, same thing. So do I go to a massage therapist? Do I go to a chiropractor? Do I go to an osteopath? Like, you know, people get confused, right? It's like what you said. You said sometimes you see people who have already seen a chiropractor. So if that's my problem, because osteoarthritis is chronic pain, right?
Not always. I mean, you could have osteoarthritis. I mean, we know that structural conditions in the body do not dictate the amount or level of pain that somebody experiences if they have it at all. There's many people with severe osteoarthritis who do not have pain. And there are people with severe osteoarthritis who have a lot of pain.
I'm thinking of my dad. Yeah. I'm thinking of my dad. He's 84 and he still rides his bike from his house to my house. You do miles. Let's say 10 kilometers. What is that? 5 miles? I don't know. Anyway, he's 84, but his whole thought is that when I stop moving, that's when it's worse. And so he's the most active man, right? But like, that's who I'm thinking of for arthritis. I'm like, who should he even go to for this?
Yeah, the key is I think I wish I had an easier answer for that, but I always do start with the basics. I mean, once the person has gone to the doctor, clearly if they have been diagnosed with osteoarthritis, you should understand the limitations of the condition. So for example, if you have osteoarthritis in the shoulder, there's going to be limited range of motion in certain ways. And you have to set proper expectations. Like if somebody can barely move their shoulder and they're 60, 70 years old like this because of osteoarthritis, there's no expectation of getting that shoulder to full range of motion. First job is to explain and set expectations on what is possible with that condition. So when we do massage work, we're going to address all of the muscles around the shoulder to improve optimal function, to get us a better sense of ease in the tissues. And we can see what will happen with the range of motion in the shoulder, but we also have to understand the limitations of the condition. So I think a lot of times it's the expectation as well, is that what is the goal? If the goal is to reduce pain, or is the goal to increase range of motion, that's going to dictate what kind of practitioner you're going to see and the kinds of expectations you will have from that condition. So for example, I'll never see somebody with frozen shoulder and say, hey, I can get your arm to full range of motion just with massage therapy, because I know that that is not a good expectation to set for that condition. And in that case, that therapy might need to be more aimed at or directed toward things like, for example, a chiropractor or a physical therapist would do, which is joint mobilization or manipulation, and or they might need some kind of medical injection therapy for that. But I always do start, and I tell people when they call me and they say, you know, I'm dealing with this issue, it's medically stable, the doctor said, hey, I can go exercise or whatever, and what should I do? I say, start with massage. Do really thorough massage work around the area, because massage work to me is very safe. It has the least chances of aggravating anything. And you see what kind of results that you get from that. And a lot of people get a great deal of pain relief from that. They get improved range of motion. It allows them to be able to start doing exercises again versus just jumping right into what I would say is joint manipulation, because that joint manipulation might be a very aggressive place to start. And it might omit that thorough massage work and just dealing with the tissues. So I do kind of have that issue with diving right into the most aggressive technique that you could do. I'm not necessarily blaming that on any industry, but to me, I think about, like, for example, a spinal manipulation is a grade 5 mobilization. What about 1, 2, 3, 4? Yeah. You know, maybe starting off with some more gentle techniques to see if we can do the least amount of work and stress on those joints and those tissues and see if we can get the greatest degree of and benefit from it with the least degree of risk.
Yeah, that actually, so I will say not all massage therapists are created equal. And no. I have seen a massage therapist once. I was in Vegas and then we decided to book a massage. And, you know, I came out of there in so much pain, my neck. And I had, you know, I have my own osteopath. I know people in the industry and I was kind of shocked because I'm like, it's like almost like what you said that, you know, why would you start at 5 if you didn't start at 1? And, you know, I didn't go in there with severe pain. I just went for a massage and I came out with severe pain. So explain that. I guess not all massage therapists are created equal, right? You do need to be careful and do your homework.
Yes. And, you know, it's unfortunate. I don't want to, you know, speak negatively about my profession, but probably one of the bigger things that aggravates me about the massage industry is the lack of progression of education over time. This is a very old discipline. It's been around for a long time, but it has really struggled to maintain a consistent upward trend of improving the quality of the education of therapists, eliminating dogma and things that we know are not true that the scientific literature does not support. And one of those things in particular is the lack of understanding of things like pain education and pain neuroscience. So when we do these things and when you teach things like pain neuroscience, it starts to alter how the therapist does their therapies. So, for example, there's still this belief in the therapeutic industry that we're breaking up knots, we're breaking up adhesions, and we're, you know, we have to pull or pry those muscle fibers apart. And that leads to therapists just being super aggressive with people, overly aggressive, and they think that that's good. And we even see these memes that are out there about, you know, a therapist driving an elbow into somebody, and that's a good thing. And it's certainly not. And it doesn't make sense. If what we're trying to do is to reduce the threat and the guarding in the central nervous system, then more aggressiveness and more pressure is not better. And in my training early on, I was taught, and I was smarter, I think, in the beginning because I had good mentors, that even then I look back and I think I was way too aggressive, because always the answer for is, if somebody was not getting better, you should push harder. And I've actually found that, you know, for many years now, the softer, the more gentle the techniques are, the more I kind of spread out my my therapeutic work with people by preparing them for what we're going to be doing and teaching them to be gentle with their nervous systems. I've gotten far better results. And I think that that's something where I'm hoping that the massage field starts to kind of really pick up. And there is a lot of movement on this forward of teaching therapists more about the neuroscience of pain and how manual therapy techniques fit into that. But certainly there is a tremendous amount of resistance, I would say, across all manual therapy disciplines, because there is so much wanting to cling to old models of that therapeutic paradigm. So that is kind of something of an issue that we face. But I always tell people, the more pain you have in particular, you need to find a therapist that is sensitive to your sensitivity.
Mm, I like that, actually. Now, one of the things that I do know about certain disciplines, just, and maybe it's by practitioner type, but you know, some people almost like become addicted. Like they start going and then they're like, oh, I need to get my back cracked, or oh, like, yeah, that's a real thing, right? Like why does that happen?
I would say that, you know, that part of that, of course, is people, you know, we do things that, and we become kind of hooked a little bit to the things that give us the relief. But part of that is also the way that professions have been designed. And for me, I've learned a lot, and in particular, that one of the things that is actually best for the person is to help shift the locus of control to the person. Mm. So you should be able, we want you to be able to get yourself out of pain and to be able to modulate your own nervous system. The more you rely on an external source to do that, the more you tend to depend or to rely on it, because you're not able to do it yourself. And that's one of the worst things is, to me, I don't see people any more than usually once a week. And there's a reason for that. I could make more money if I see people three times a week. If there are people in a lot of pain, I might see them more frequently. But the goal is to get that person to be able to get their nervous system to be self-sustaining. I do the manual therapy. The goal is to move things forward. And you do your home exercises. If your back is bothering you, then you do the exercises that I gave you to build up resiliency. The best thing ever is for somebody to say, hey, I felt really good after I saw you. The tension started to creep back, but I did my exercises and my back felt better afterward. And I say, great, now you understand that my job is to push things forward. You do not need a bazillion massage sessions. You do not need a bazillion chiropractic adjustments in order for your body to heal. Because if that did not, we needed that, certainly we would have never made it to this point. As a primitive human being, we would have died out long ago if we had a subluxation in our spine and there was no chiropractor to fix it. So our bodies are very resilient, and constantly pushing forward on that message and helping people be empowered with their own health, that when they see their healthcare provider, if they feel themselves slipping into that pattern of needing that passive care constantly or always in order to get themselves out of pain, to have that discussion with their healthcare provider to say, hey, what can I do to help myself? That is music to the ears of a lot of health practitioners who's starting to see people losing the ability to kind of modulate their own situation and starting to rely on the therapist too much.
That is huge. That's like music to my ears, because as any practitioner, even for myself, education is key, right? You want people to be able to take, that's what I do. I work with women for 3 months, and then it's like, my hope is that they're set and they've learned all they needed to learn. And they can go off and do as they should for their wellness. So I love to hear that, Sam. Now, I'm going to shift gears, because I just want to ask you one question. It's a big one, because people in midlife, what is the biggest reason why somebody comes to you and you use your technique? What is the most major reason for this chronic pain that you see? And I'm going to ask you specifically in midlife, what do you see the most?
I would say that what happens is that somewhere in the mix of having some kind of ache or pain, and a lot of people have not been let's say, active. They've started to become deconditioned and they haven't exercised in a while and so forth. And maybe they've started a fitness program or they've started to take initiative and go out and be more active. And they start to deal with some of these aches and pains that, whereas before, like we had talked about, they would have deleted that back in their 20s. Now there's more concerns. And the concerns are based upon that misinformation is like, as you get older, you've got to be careful and you're going to get injured. So we've actually become a little less resilient and more hesitant to get out and be more active because we start dealing with aches and pains. So either one of two things happens. People are more apprehensive about starting and they've become a little phobic of moving because of it tends to aggravate their aches and pains a little bit. So they won't get started. And that fear is generating or contributing more to their chronic pain situation because they need to move. Yeah. And then on the opposite end, we have people that just, you know, they put their foot on the gas pedal and then they, you know, shred the wheels and they go forward and they don't pay attention to their body at all. And because they think that they're 20 again, and they're just pushing it too hard and they're starting to deal with these aches and pains and they're frustrated that those things are limiting them. So either number one, I have to get somebody to start not being afraid to move and start doing a lot more. Or number two, I got to get somebody to start putting the brakes on a little bit because they're not paying attention to their body. Those I'd say are the two different scenarios and starting to break up that information that they're being told. Again, the messages of saying you've got a bad back, you need to be careful, you're getting older, slow down. Both of those are not true in either one of those cases. It's just that the person needs to develop different or better strategies on how to go about being active in a way that's smart and effective and that they're not going to have constant setbacks. It's normal for us to have aches and pains. Everybody's going to have a back that goes out once a year, you know, where we get bent over and our back bothers us. These are normal phenomena. It's how we cope with them and the strategies that we use to move past them and to continue to be active, which is going to make the difference, you know, as we get through this patch of time that seems to be the most challenging, which is roughly between 35 and about 55 or 60. Because when we start to see that people move past 60, we start to see the incidence of pain reports actually goes down. So we talked about arthritis, for example, and I would challenge anybody to look this up, is the graph of arthritis. If you look at over time, I'll go this way because you're probably on the reverse side as me. You know, when we're young, we start to see arthritis goes up, 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 up as we get to 70s and 80s. But when we look at incidence of pain, people going to the doctor and reporting pain issues and so forth, we see a graph that goes like this in the beginning. But once it gets to about 55, 60, it does this. So pain reports go down as arthritis continues to go up. We would expect pain to continue going up as arthritis goes up. And that is not the case. That's not how it works. So everybody will have arthritis, but most of the issues are there in the middle, in that mid-range. I blame that on a number of things, but it's oftentimes where people really start to become inactive as well. You know, as you get older, joints settle in and so forth, we start to kind of ache a little less and we go out and we're like, you know what, I'm going to go move or do my thing anyway, right? So I am seeing this trend of times also where older clients are coming in who are showing up in gyms and so forth who are in their 60s, and I think that's a phenomenal thing. But there in the middle is where we have the issue. It's somebody who is not moving enough or they're not putting the brakes on. And somewhere in the middle, we got to find a happy medium as we age.
You know, what you're saying makes so much sense because when I first joined a personal training gym, my trainer said to me, she goes, you know, you're just really uncomfortable with being uncomfortable. She's so funny. And I'm like, you know, you're right. And I never pushed myself like that. And so she knew how far to push me because I didn't have any issues. I just didn't move enough, Sam. So I have two dogs. So I walk my dogs fine. Walk, and I say this all the time, walking is not enough. It's just not enough movement. And, you know, my parents are both very active, but I'm like, you guys got to start lifting some weights or using some resistant bands anyway, if you don't want to do weights. My dad probably does more than my mom, but I'm seeing this, you know, I hate to say it, but people just becoming really lazy and they just don't want to move their body and there's every excuse in the world why. And, you know, I remember myself in my 20s, I was never, you know, an athletic person, but I was also only 20. So my body moved perfectly. If I skip a workout, I treat it like it's an appointment. I do not miss my workouts. It's an appointment. And if I do miss my workouts, I can feel it. And I'm like, I better damn well do something because I have to move at home or whatever. Because my father always says, if you don't move it, you're going to lose it, right? This is coming from my 84-year-old dad. So I love that you talk about that because people just don't get how important it is to move no matter what. And I mean, you don't want to move in the sense of hurting yourself, but you got to move. You just got to move. Yes. So, you know, I have many theories as to why that happens. One is stress. Another thing that happens is hormones, right? Our hormones change in midlife. That's a big factor, especially in women in midlife. Like, what else do you think maybe is a cause of why? I mean, there's the whole complacency, there's stress, there's so many. And then, you know, along with it, diet, right? Like, yes. Of course, I'm going to talk about diet. I'm a nutritionist. And so for me, it's like, okay, we don't have to be on a diet. It's more about a lifestyle and eating whole real foods and cooking at home and not eating garbage, right? Like, what are your thoughts on, did I miss anything on why this occurs?
The big one, I would say, and that's where a lot of my stuff is moving toward, it's the brain. We need to stop thinking about our workouts and so forth and the things that we do as purely aesthetic goals. I think that, you know, especially I think as a positive revolution, everybody is becoming a little less fixated on having a six pack or having all of these things. And because those are generally, I would say, generally speaking, arbitrary goals, it's the chase or the movement toward achieving goals, which is important. Brains work on constantly being stimulated and growing new wrinkles in the brains. We're seeing a whole host of neurodegenerative conditions, mostly because we're not using our brain. And if we see in the elderly population, we're starting to see trends of these neurodegenerative diseases and actually look at the therapies that are being used positively to impact these situations. We're talking about crossword puzzles. We're talking about getting and engaging into simple activities that challenge brains. It means to me that we're so under-challenged that our brains are deteriorating. And we have to understand from a primitive standpoint, the very primitive standpoint, that a lot of our brain activity is fixated on movement. That's what we're meant to do. And if we don't move, our brain starts to deteriorate. So it's very important that not only that we do movement, but we're challenged with movement. We set goals, we attain them. We challenge our body's ability and our brain's ability to do lots of different things. Nervous systems are meant to evolve and to be challenged. Doesn't have to be severe challenges, but it needs to be constant. A lot of times when we're young, I think it's said within the first, 3 to 5 years of life, our brains grow more in terms of our neurally and brain development more than we ever will throughout the remainder of our lives. But this process continually slows as to most people are, you know, we're all forced to go to school up until the age of 18. And then we go to college, some of us, and we're being stretched. After that, whether or not we're stretched is remain to be seen based on the individual and what they do in their life. If they choose a profession that they're very motivated to do and they're constantly learning, they're being challenged. But some people will not choose those types of professions. And it means to me that they need to be challenged in other areas of their lives to continue to seek growth, however that looks. But we're actually telling them, and after school, we're far less mobile. We don't have physical fitness in high school. There's lots of things that are going on. So our brain is not being challenged in many ways. And I don't think it's effective purely just by challenging the brain with brain-based or activities that, you know, sitting in front of a computer, but we need to use our body as well. So you need to find and work with different types of exercise programs and fitness that meet your motivation style and what you like to do. You don't have to bodybuild. You don't have to do CrossFit. You don't have to stand on balance balls and discs all day if you don't want to. Pick the thing that you're most motivated by, but do something and don't just do it with a degree of showing up and then just going through the motions. At a point, you have to constantly be challenging the physiology. And I think there's something to be said, which is something that I'm strongly for with my clients, is to fall in love with the process of the discipline. The point of doing some things is just to be disciplined so you can train your will. And as you do so, you'll be able to apply that strategy to other things and realize the value of it is training your brain and evolving, and we'll get all of these other positive effects that go with it. And even with diet, I found for me is a strong motivation now is that I'm not super motivated by aesthetics. Health stuff, certainly I am. But sometimes it's enough for me to be motivated because I find it difficult. And because I find it difficult, I'm now compelled to want to do it because it means growth to me. So it's assigning that meaning to things. And that neurodegenerative decline, I think, is enough to scare most people as to losing your mind and developing a neurodegenerative condition simply because you're not using it. And that should be something that we should also focus on as a strong motivator for people.
I love that. Now, in terms of your programs, tell us where, because we're almost up to an hour, where does somebody find you? Do you have online programs? I don't know if you do. Like, how would somebody work with you and your technique?
Well, I've offered a few things, and now I've gotten a lot more toward kind of systemizing my work. I spent the majority of my career actually doing the work in practice, and now it's a lot of sharing the message and kind of putting things together in a way that I can help other people achieve some of the same benefits without necessarily seeing me in live practice. So I'm very active on social media, Instagram in particular. I put a lot of my mechanical type stuff on there, which people seem to really like because it's easy to visually see. So checking out on Instagram on Release Muscle Therapy, that's the handle. On my website, I invite people to, I have a free membership area that has a lot of my tools and resources. I'm constantly creating little eBooks and so forth to help overcome certain types of problems. I'd say the thing that has probably been the most valuable to people is a digital book that I had written originally was for kind of putting together all of the research on the things that I'm talking about. Rather than just writing a book and saying, hey, just believe me, I'm saying, here is the key points. Why does this work for pain? Why does that work for pain? What does the research say? And here's the research if you want to go read it. And there's a lot of stuff in there, and I clearly add some of my own anecdotal evidence of what I think works. But I wanted it to be a compendium or a resource guide for people if they have questions on things like, is this true or is this false? So that book is called Why Didn't My Doctor Tell Me That? And I thought it was funny because a lot of my clients had said that. So why did my doctor tell me this? It's so easy. And I'm like, well, you know, that's a whole nother topic to itself.
No kidding.
But I wanted that to be in there and say, well, you know, there's a way that you can learn all of this material on your own and be a good advocate for your own care. And stick the book inside of my membership area. And that's available on my website at releasemuscletherapy.com.
That is awesome. I really enjoyed our conversation today, Sam. I thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me. Loved it.
Join me next week where I cover off more exciting topics. I hope to continue to engage you and excite you and show you that living in your 40s, 50s, and beyond can be exciting, balanced, and healthful. Bye for now.